Hello, I'm James Borden. I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 13th of 2005. And that's pretty wild. I was actually in a meeting this morning, and everybody was sharing. I was sitting there listening during the meeting, and the whole time I was just sitting there thinking, I'm like, it's just amazing that I'm still able to complete full sentences with as much stuff as I put in my body. And it was just the one night I didn't stroke out, have a brain aneurysm or whatever, because you pay some, I don't know about you, but you know, you pay some hefty dues to get in here, and it's good to be here. I was talking to Merle before the meeting. I was here one night when Merle spoke for 28 minutes, so all I need to do is beat Merle. So it's 6:03. So if I can get to 6:34, I've got it. So that's my mark, and it feels real good to be at this meeting. I tell you, it's you know, I got sober here. You know, this was my first job in AA. I was the coffee maker, and the guys in this meeting, they trusted me enough to make coffee. And you might not think that's a big deal, but you know, the coffee's got to get made. And before, I'll talk a little bit about this in a minute, but before, when I was coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had had coffee jobs where I would get drunk and not show up. And I would call people in a panic. Like, I'd at least call, but I'd call people and say, hey, I'm not going to come tonight. You know, I got this going on at work, or, you know, something. And, you know, but this time around, you know, that coffee pot, you know, there's just something about it. There's just something about having a job in a home group, showing up every week, no matter what, and just doing it. This was my home group for about a year. Now my home group's in Charlottesville. It's the Common Solution Group. It meets at 7:30 on Thursdays. And I've seen a lot of you there. And next time I'm the speaker seeker, I'm going to come to this meeting. And I'm going to just start jotting down names. But like I said, it's just real good to get back in here and be up to Madison tonight. I really enjoy to hunt, and I hunt, you know, right down the road. Made some really good friends doing that, and you know, my first sponsor in sobriety, you know, Billy, you know, he's here and just a lot of good stuff, and it's really an honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to kind of just in a general way tell you what it was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And, you know, that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you pick up a little bit about me that you can identify with, great. If not, you know, there's lots of people, you know, they get a lot of really good speakers here. You might identify with somebody. And that process of identification was huge for me. Because when I came to AA, I'd walk in even before I heard what you said, and I knew I was different. I knew what was wrong with me was different than anybody in here, so I don't want to hear it, because I've got to come up with a new solution. I'm going to manage it. I'm going to manage my own life, and I'm going to figure a way out. And all I did was, you know, stay drunk until I came in here just totally out of answers, totally out of hope. And in that state, I became teachable. I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, I grew up in Charlottesville, and I went to Albemarle High School. I graduated in 1992. So if you're doing the math, I'm 36 years old. I just turned 36 in October. My very first drink was when I was about 13 years old, and I'll never forget it. You know, I'll never forget how that drink made me feel. You know, the whole time I was growing up, even at a very early age, very early on, I remember, you know, wishing I had, you know, a different set of parents, wishing I was a different person, that just a different family, just something, because I just didn't feel right. You know, something was wrong. Even at age 13, 14, I was thinking about committing suicide. just because I was just very uncomfortable with who I was. The very first time I drank, I'll never forget the way it made me feel. It turned a switch on in my head to where I just did not care what was going on. I felt good. My perception of life changed instantly. The people that I was afraid of, the parents I had, the circumstances of my life all lit up, and it all looked really good, and I didn't have any problems. And I'll never forget that switch. I'll never forget it, because I still got it in my head. I know I do. But I've got the ability to instantly change the way I look at the world. And I had the phenomenon of craving that the book talks about, even at a very early age, where when I drank one, I couldn't stop, and I overshot the mark. And that's a little bit embarrassing when you're growing up. You know, you're growing up with people that, you know, they're drinking two or three drinks, and they can stop. But if you can't stop, you'll do stuff in blackouts. It's embarrassing. You know, like, I remember one night, very early on, you know, I woke up on a bathroom floor in my own vomit, and, you know, in my underwear at a party, and, you know, everybody was there, you know, laughing at me and pointing at me. And then, like, the very next day, I'm going to school, and people are, like, telling me what had happened. And it was embarrassing. And, you know, it started out like that. But experiences like that is stuff that I started to push down inside of me and just drink to get rid of that, because I know what makes that embarrassment, that shame, that feeling of being uncomfortable. I know what makes that go away. And by no means at age 13 did I become a daily drinker, but you know what? I started drinking pretty much every weekend. And when I was... See, I graduated, and I finished 322 out of 327 in my graduating class. There was only five people that did less than I did. And I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I'm not that bad, you know. It's just my sisters both got, you know, 3.0s in college, and I have the same blood and makeup, so I should be able to get somewhere close to that. But anyway, I almost finished dead last just because I wasn't an alcoholic that could drink and function and, you know, study, you know, show up to work. You know, when I drink, I don't want to do nothing. You know, I don't care. I just want to get drunk. I want to put whatever else I can into my body to just get me by. My parents, you know, bless their heart, they saw the path I was going down, and they, you know, didn't have money by any stretch of the imagination, but they borrowed money to put me into a postgraduate program. And in that environment, I excelled. And what it was a military school. And they told you when to wake up, when to go to bed, and when to study. It's kind of like prison, but with academics involved, and that they can throw you out of there if they want to. But it was a very structured environment, and I did well. I got my grades up, and you know, I got into a college, and you know, I even made my decision on where to attend college. Based on my drinking, you know, I knew if I went to a normal university that there was going to be trouble, because I saw, you know, my friends at Radford, Virginia Tech, and, you know, I'd go down there for a weekend, and it's a whole, you know, party full of people and me, and the whole time I'm just standing there just feeling so uncomfortable, so out of place. My head's talking to me like, there's something wrong with you. Everybody knows it. They're just waiting for you to leave to talk about it. You don't fit in. You're not tall enough. You're not whatever. You know, my brain's talking to me. And I got to make that go away. And the only thing I know to make it go away is alcohol. And when I have that first drink, I can't stop. I don't want to stop, but I can't stop even if I want to. So I know normal universities is not going to fit the bill. So I went to a military college. And in that school, I like the year of postgraduate school, I was told when to wake up, when to study, you know, basically your life's kind of planned out for you, and you don't have any freedom, which was good for a guy like me, because I didn't do good with it. But as soon as I had, like, the first 2 months, you can't do anything. You know, you're just locked up like a rat. That's what you are. You're a rat, and that's what they call you. And after about 2 months, you get a little bit of freedom, and you're assigned to an upperclassman. And the upperclassman is called a dyke. I don't know why they call it that. That's just what they call it. But it's kind of like a sponsor in AA. They kind of like show you the ropes and everything like that. But I told the guy, I said, you know, very first weekend, very first freedom. And I'm like, you know, I want some liquor. I said, you know, I said, I want to get drunk. I said, give me a bottle. And the guy got me a bottle. And, I mean, it was on. You know, it's just like when I had that one drink, I drank the whole bottle in about 20 minutes. And that was after being, you know, dry for, you know, a couple months, not having nothing. And then that started the cycle in there. I was able somehow to keep the wheels on for about 2 years and get, you know, I got good grades and all that. But my alcoholism, it doesn't rest. You know, it just doesn't stay put at age 20, age 25 or whatever. It's a progressive, you know, fatal illness. So my behavior, you know, while drunk started getting more and more outrageous. You know, I was doing stuff in blackouts that I swore up and down I would never do. You know, I wasn't brought up to be this type of person, and yet I'm doing this stuff. And when I'm sober and I wake up in the morning, that feeling of shame, guilt, remorse, you know, the four horsemen are on me. And, you know, I can't take it. So the window of me being sober and drunk got less and less. And like I said, my parents weren't wealthy people. You know, my dad was a house painter. You know, always went to work. Always we never went without. But they borrowed a lot of money to put me in school. And my third class year consisted of smoking pot, playing foosball during the week, and then on the weekends getting drunk and getting some white powder and running up to a JMU and selling it. And that was my life. And I got a 0.0 both semesters and flunked out and came back home to Charlottesville. And thought I had all the answers. You know, you could not tell me anything. You know, I know what I'm doing. Trust me. And I got a job on a, I still have this job. That's crazy. I was 21 when I went to work there. And, you know, I went to work at this place, and what happened there was my alcoholism just really just kicked into full gear. It was kind of an alcoholic dream job. You know, I had a house on the property where I lived. I didn't have to, like, when I wake up in the morning, I could just walk to the shop and start working. You know, nobody really checked up on me. I had a lot of freedom, and I could pretty much do whatever I wanted. And the people that were in charge of me, you know, drank just as much as I did. And if not, then we were getting, you know, drugs from the same people. So, I mean, it just didn't matter. My first legal consequences, I'm going to back up a little bit. You know, when I remember early on in my 20s, I had a meltdown. You know, I had I guess it was a nervous breakdown. I don't know what it was. But I just snapped. And I think I was at that jumping off place, the spot in life where I just couldn't imagine life sober or drunk. And the window opened up. And when I was there, I did not go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a hospital in Lexington, Virginia. And the people really didn't know what to do with me. So they stuck me in this, like, I don't know what type of group it was, but, I mean, it was some crazy people. I mean, it was, they had a poor girl in there that looked like she hadn't eaten anything in 3 years. They had a guy that was in the advanced stages of alcoholism. He had, like, sores all over his arms. He was talking to people that weren't there. There was just people in there for a whole host of problems. And I'm 21 years old. I got my health. I'm halfway athletic. And I'm like, I don't have this problem. I said, I don't know what these people got, but I've got it made. So anyway, that was my first, you know, chance at help, and it just didn't stick. I got in my first legal trouble. You know, I got a DUI. You know, and during that DUI, I assaulted a police officer and was put on good behavior. And then it wasn't a year later, I got in trouble again. And this time around, it wasn't going to be a slap on the wrist. They were going to give me the time I had back from the other offense. So, lo and behold, I come to an AA meeting. And when I came to AA at age 24, I was getting a court paper signed. You know, that's how I came to AA. I came late. I left early. My family doctor was my sponsor. And I really didn't do anything Alcoholics Anonymous suggested. And I remember coming into my meeting, and it was the old Charter Hospital building in Charlottesville. They had a gymnasium, and I walked in, just blended into the back, and I just don't remember, you know, too much about it. And then I went to jail. I did my time in jail. Came out of jail, and this is embarrassing. You know, having your mom pick you up in a minivan on work release at the local jail, that's embarrassing. But that's just where my life had gotten to, and I just had nowhere else to go. My very first AA sponsor, you know, I'm still friends with the guy today. You know, great guy. His wife's in AA, and there's good people. We worked the steps a little bit, but you know, I just didn't have this problem. You know, I was like, I'm the guy in AA. You know, I walk in, and before you even tell me, my case is different. I don't have what you have. You know, I think this stuff, and I think it's true. My parents, if they would have given me more, I wouldn't have drank so much. If I didn't have this problem with depression, I wouldn't want to drink. If I just woke up one morning and I had the right girlfriend, the right job, or if I just had some money, I wouldn't want to live this way anymore. And I could just straighten up. And, you know, I really thought this stuff. And it had to get smashed out of me. It just had to get smashed. It took every drink it took, and I'm glad it did. And so what happened to me was at age 24, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 7 years. You know, maybe getting a week here, a week there. I was a terrible newcomer. You know, I was terrible. I mean, I'd come in, I weigh about 174 pounds now. Back then, I was a steakhead. I weighed like 225. I was all like just crazy. I had this crazy look in my eye, and I'd threaten people at meetings. I'd come late. I'd come late to the meeting, and I'd bring up the topic. And my topic usually consisted of at least saying the F-bomb five times. I'd tell everybody to keep the topic away from me. I'm like, don't share at me and try to belittle me. It's just crazy. And then I'd stop. And then after about two people shared, I'd get up and leave the meeting. And that's how I treated Alcoholics Anonymous. And this isn't really an amends. This is just acting with some common courtesy now. But I cleaned up my mouth in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is something my sponsor taught me very early on by showing me the ropes. And the reason I do that is it's not for me. It's for, you know, say my mom was in this meeting right now and somebody was standing up here and saying some of the stuff I used to say. I'd feel very uncomfortable. Well, you know what? There's women in here. That's somebody's mom. You know, there's people's grandfathers in here, people's brothers, sisters. They don't want to hear that stuff. And, you know, and not only that, it's, you know, in a church, you know, AA is not entitled to meet in churches. You know, that's just a courtesy the church extends to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, certain groups. You know, if the preacher's in the next room with his kids and I'm up here talking like that, he could say, you know what, I don't care what y'all are doing, I don't care what you're talking about, after tonight, get out. I don't want to hear it anymore. And I've heard of that actually happening in AA meetings. And that's, try to start thinking about other people. That was hammered into me very early on. Because I was just very unaware of how my behavior affected other people. Because I'm just so self-absorbed and everything is about me. But at age 30, I had my last drink. And it didn't even rate in the top 1,000 of bad nights for me. You know, nothing really drastic happened. It had been a hard weekend. And usually, you know, I always said it was like a bad weekend. I'm like, if I can just stay sober on Monday, I might be able to make it to Wednesday. But if I drink Monday, I'm going to be drunk every night of the week. And this was a Monday, and I drank, and I got hammered. And I remember I was at a bar in Charlottesville, the Blue Light Grill. And I asked the bartender, I said, what's the strongest drink you have? And he said, this is going to be bad if I can't remember it. Can't even remember what it was. Again, that might be a good thing, it might be a bad thing. But he made me the drink and I chugged it. And I remember after I chugged it, I had drank enough that night to get to the point where my brain shuts off. And that night my brain didn't shut off. I mean, my brain was clear as a bell. And I knew my life was going absolutely nowhere. I knew the type of man I was, that I wished to God I could kill myself. I just didn't have the guts. I knew I could not stop drinking, and I did not know what to do. I was in a hell of a place. The next morning I woke up, picked up the phone, and I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, what do I need to do? I'll do anything. And they told me to go check into a treatment center. And that was something that I had fought tooth and nail against. Because for one, I'm tight with my money. And for two, I had a big time resentment against treatment centers. I viewed them as vultures that made their money on human misery. And that I'd rather die than give them any money. But I went. You know, I checked myself into this hospital, and I'm glad I did. You know, it served its purpose. It got me out of my environment. I was doing some other stuff besides just drinking. And, you know, it was helpful to get away and get dried out on that stuff. But, it served its purpose. It, you know, dried me out. And I didn't get confused that was going to be the cure-all. I knew that was just a start. That if I was going to have any sort of hope, I was going to have to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. You know, and I'll tell you, one of the best lessons I learned in that treatment center was when I was in there, everybody, like when we'd have our group session, everybody was sitting around the table like, man, when I get out of here, I'm just going to get my job back. I'm going to do this. I'm going to break up with my girlfriend. When I get out of here, I'm going to break up with my girlfriend, and then I'm going to be okay. And everybody had a plan in that treatment center. Everybody had a plan. And I had no plan. My planning days were over. You know, I had totally given myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that started with sponsorship. You know, I had somebody else making decisions for me for a little while, and they still do. You know, I mean, not one of these people that, you know, call my sponsor when I go buy a cup of coffee. But if I got something going on in my life and I don't want to make the call, I'll call him and say, hey, listen, this is going on. You know, what do I need to do? What do you suggest? And sometimes he'll say, do whatever you're going to do and have an experience. But it'll usually, what he tells me is better than what I'm going to come up with on my own. I guarantee you that. I came out of the treatment center and joined a home group, got a sponsor, and started taking the steps. Those were the first three things I was told to do when I came to AA 7 years before that. and it was the very last thing I tried. You know, I tried everything else in between that except that. I'm like, it's free. It can't work, can it? But something took hold. You know, I did the steps. You know, I didn't do them perfect, but I did them. You know, I did them to the best of my ability, and I, you know, stayed active in AA. You know, I made lots of AA meetings. I made friends in the fellowship. I car rides to meetings. You know, that for me helped me more than anything very early on. Riding in a car with people that are about your age or somewhere close and listening to how crazy they are in their head, and they're like 2 or 3 years sober, and you're like, well, wait a minute, I think the same stuff. Maybe I'm just like them. You know, maybe if I do what they do, I'll be okay in AA. Maybe I'm not different. And that feeling of different started to just melt away, and I became a garden variety drunk. And I fell in love with AA. I was going to conferences. I still go to conferences, and I'm still an active member of my home group. And I have a job in my home group. You know, right now I'm the group chair, and I make sure I raise my hand at every home group meeting, and I make sure I have a job. And the guys I'm fortunate enough to work with, I tell them they got to have a job. You know, they got to make lots of meetings, and we're going to take the steps. You know, if you don't want to do that, that's fine. You know, you don't have to. But, you know, I don't have any experience staying sober by not going through with the program. You know, every time I tried to do that, I got drunk. And it's all good stuff. I'll talk briefly about the amends process, because for me, that's where my life changed. You know, the whole design for Alcoholics Anonymous is to change my perception on life and the things around me. And that's as a result of doing the steps, because the same person will drink again. And I prove that to myself every time. And my big change in perception started during the amends process. And I'll tell you about one. My father, when I came into AA, me and my dad basically had no relationship. I had pulled a knife on this man. I'd had the cops called on me on numerous occasions. And I basically blamed him for what was wrong in my life. I'm like, if you hadn't have been that mean SOB growing up and treated us better and not, you know, slammed the table over, if you'd have given me more, I'd have been okay. I got all that stuff down on my inventory, and after, you know, disregarding the other person entirely, you know, disregard them entirely. You know, where had I been at fault? You know, well, you know, when he borrowed money to put me through school, I totally just blew it. You know, I pulled a knife on him. You know, I threatened his life. I did a few other things. I caused him numerous sleepless nights on my behavior. You know, I brought embarrassment to the family. I was in jail. And the shift started changing. I started to just not focus entirely on what he had done to me. I started looking at it from an entirely different angle, and it freaked me out, because that change does not come about just sitting on the couch and praying about it. It's actual actions that I was taking. And I'll never forget when I made amends to my dad. You know, we were riding down the road, and I said, God, help me. And we got out of the car, and I let him know what I needed to tell him. And then I said, is there anything else I've done I'm unaware of that's hurt you? And it was like he exhaled. It was like right then and there, my father changed. I changed, my dad changed, and it was a result of this program. I have never looked at that man the same after that. I love my dad. I was talking to him on the way up here tonight. We have got a great relationship. I consider him one of my closest friends. He's not, I mean, I don't look at him as a dad. It's not like a formal relationship. I joke with him. And I tell you, the best gift is we don't have to manufacture conversation. It just happens naturally. It's comfortable. But he was kind enough to let me in on a little of the things that he had done to me, that I had done to him. And he said, "Well, yeah, I want to start knowing about your life. You know, include me." He said, "I'd like it if you came by. I'd like it if you called me and let me know what was going on." And you know, I've done that. You know, I'm not perfect. You know, I'm not the AA, you know, poster child. But I mean, I've done. I try my best. My mother, she passed away about a year and a half ago. I made amends to her. I'm not beating myself over the head, but I was sober long enough in AA that my mom saw the change in me, and she loved that. She loved the people I was around. She loved seeing everything. But there was still some of my behavior and my actions towards my mom that could have been a little bit different. You know, it's one thing telling somebody, you know, making amends. It's another thing living that way. And I don't know what it was about my mom, but she could push my buttons better than anybody on the planet. But, you know, I love my mom. And it was made clear to me that when somebody dies, the relationship's not over. The relationship is just different. That, you know, there's nothing ends. And not. This part, you know, Billy will laugh at this because you fired me when I said, and that helped me out. I got hired on with half pay after that, but I got into the amends process and I made a couple, you know, right out of the gate. But I stopped, you know, I stopped making amends, and my sponsor, you know, made it clear to me, you know, that if I didn't want to go through with the rest of the process, then I didn't have a sponsor anymore. That, you know, good luck, whatever. And that was enough to just give me the jolt to move forward. And I didn't want to pay any money. You know, I thought it was my money that I was going to have to pay back. You know, that was a biggie for me. Like, everybody, like, talks about steps 4 and 5 being scary. You know, steps 8 and 9 terrified me. Because I did not want to come off money. And I didn't want to go back to people that I had hurt and look them in the eye and tell them exactly what I had done. I didn't want to do that. You know, I'll sit there and complain all day, but taking action like that, uh-uh. But I started doing this stuff. The institution I was resentful at, I wrote a check, paid it. I haven't had a resentment at that institution since. A facility in Charlottesville that I had vandalized. I went back and looked the club manager in the eye. I told him exactly what I did, and I've made restitution for that. You know, I still need to, you know, give them a little bit of my time. You know, money here, money there. You know, stealing, paying stuff back, and you know, through that process, all that stuff. You know, walking away from an experience where you look somebody face to face and you walk out, I started feeling good about myself. I was able to look myself in the eye, in the mirror. My whole perception changed. And one here recently, there was a guy that hunts on the property beside me. And we had never gotten along, ever. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I caught him on the property, and he said he had shot an animal on their property, and it ran over. Well, I lit into this guy like none other. I mean, I was cussing him. I think I threatened him. And, I mean, I'm sober. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm acting like this. And so it ended. He left, and I left. And for 2 years, the 200 acres that I hunted on felt like it was the size of this room, because I was scared to death that I was going to shoot something on the property I had permission, and it was going to run over there, and it was going to be World War III. I was scared to run into this guy at service stations and places I knew where he hung out, because I did not want to. I just knew something bad was going to happen. And this is where sponsorship comes into play, because a friend of mine that was with me that day is a member of AA that I respect. He's got great sobriety, and he told me the direction he gave me was to not worry about it, that it's going to take care of itself. You know, people are like that. You did the right thing. When I ran that by my sponsor after a year, he was like, well, why are you resentful at him? Is it because you treated him poorly? And I knew where it was going. I was like, oh, God. And I was like, yeah, I did. You know, I cussed the guy out. He's a father. He's got kids. And I was like, I treated him like a dog. And he was like, well, you need to make that right. You know, you need to go make amends. And it took me a year to do it, but I just did it. And what I did was I went down to the store where I knew he was going to be at, and I tracked him down. And he was in there buying his stuff, and I walked in. I said, hey, Mr. Blah. I said, how you doing? And he looked up at me, and he was just like, oh, God. And I was like, I've been trying to run into you for a little while now. I need to talk to you. And so as we're walking outside, he's like, well, what is it? And I'm like, about 2 years ago, the way I acted towards you was dead wrong. You know, I said a lot of things that, you know, I really were way out of line. You know, I was my behavior was inexcusable, and if there's any way I can make it right, I'm willing to do that. And he was just like, it was weird. And he was like, you're apologizing? I said, yeah, I'm apologizing. And he's like, you know, about a year ago, James, when we shot something and you came through on a four-wheeler, right after the shot, just smiling and grinning and waving your hand like you were getting ready to call the cops. He goes, that made me so mad, I wanted to blow up. And he was like, I was like, well, if I could have gone back, you know, I would have definitely done it different. You know, I just want you to know it's over. You know, that behavior is over. And we walked away from that conversation after a handshake. And I've enjoyed this season more than any season I've had in the past 6 years. You know, that land I'm on, I'm loving every minute of it. It's good stuff. If I see him, I smile, I wave at him. And, you know, that's just a resentment for a piece of hunting property. You know, if I carry a resentment, it makes the world I live in the size of this room. It shuts me down. It keeps me out of the ball game. I become ineffective to the people around me. I'm less effective at work. I'm tired all the time because I'm walking around with that stuff in me. And it's just exhausting living that way. It took me 2 years to straighten that out. So hopefully I'm learning how to, you know, live by principles. And, you know, so I cause a little bit of less damage. I've got a job I've had for 15 years. You know, I wake up on a daily basis. I ask God for help. I ask God to help me be a useful employee. I walk out of my house. I do the best job I can at work. I get off, and you go to an AA meeting 5 nights a week. That might not sound like an exciting life to you, but you know what? I'm happy with it. I don't have creditors calling me. I have a little bit of debt, but I can pay it no problem every month. And I have a whole host of friends. I'm in a fellowship where I've got a life and people around me that is just awesome. You know, I remember Lynn back when you used to knit in meetings. And she did, Ann. Back in Earliesville, and I've known her for a long time. I've gone to conferences with Merle. I've got to know Sam, Billy. I've just got to know a lot of good people in AA. You know, a lot of my closest friends are in this fellowship, and it's I try to help other alcoholics. You know, I try to help them, and I try to do what I can. For a while, I was the guy in AA that if somebody came up to me and talked about sponsorship, I'd say, well go ask him. You know, that's a good guy to ask. You know, I don't do that anymore. You know, I felt like I had nothing to give somebody. And that's a lie. You know, I got a lot to give somebody. You know, I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I can live with a little bit of grace and dignity today. And when I see my family, they like it that I'm there. I'm a part of my niece and nephew's life. And I've got more responsibility, and I'm in better relationship with my employer than I've ever been in my life. And I just need this on a daily basis. You know, there'll never be a point in my life where I'm drunk proof. You know, if I get away from the fellowship, if I get away from AA for long enough, I get crazy. You know, it's all about me. You know, I'm still a guy. I wake up on a daily basis and I want something. Now, I don't know what it is, but I just want something. I start thinking about a new vehicle. I start thinking about some money or a new woman. And I get this stuff in my head and I just want something. And it's just the way I am. And what AA does with sponsorship, the steps, and being active in the fellowship, it just distracts me enough that I'm at least somewhat effective. And it's amazing. You know, I'm working with a guy now. I met him this morning. And I just try to pass on what's been, you know, freely given to me. And Billy, that's all I got. I beat Merle by 10 minutes.